News. I'm Gene Randall. Officials in southern Afghanistan say a roadside bomb explosion today killed a senior military commander and wounded at least three other people, including a local journalist. Separately, an apparent drone attack in the southeast is said to have killed at least six civilians, one of them a newborn. The Taliban took responsibility for the roadside bombing in Helmand province, where most of the districts are either controlled or strongly influenced by the insurgent group. There is a beefed-up police presence in London today in the wake of yesterday's fatal terrorist attack at London Bridge. The assailant was shot dead by police. Usman Khan had served less than half of his 16-year sentence for a terrorism conviction. He was paroled in 2018. AP's Zaria Shackley is in London.
Two people were killed and three wounded in the attack. Neil Basu, London's police counter-terrorism chief, said 28-year-old Usman Khan was attending a program that works to educate prisoners when he launched Friday's attack, just yards from the site of a deadly 2017 van and knife rampage. Basu said the suspect appeared to be wearing a bomb vest, but it turned out to be a hoax explosive device. Police said they were treating the stabbing as a terrorist attack and were not actively looking for other suspects. Health officials said one of the wounded was in critical but stable condition. One was stable and the third had less serious injuries. Zaria Shackley, London.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is questioning British sentencing and parole practices.
This system simply isn't working. It does not make sense for us as a society to be putting people convicted of terrorist offences, of serious violent offences, out on early release. And we argue that people should serve the term of which they're sentenced.
In the Netherlands, police are searching for a suspect who stabbed three young people in a Friday evening attack in The Hague's central shopping district. The victims, all minors, have since been released from the hospital. From Washington, this is VOA News. Albanian Prime Minister Edi Rama says the search and rescue operation for earthquake victims in his country has ended. The death toll so far is 50, including seven children ages 2 to 8, with 900 people injured. More than 5,000 Albanians are homeless. 1,200 buildings were destroyed in the 6.4 magnitude quake on Tuesday. There have been aftershocks ever since. Here in the U.S., the House Judiciary Committee has given President Donald Trump a week to make a decision on the panel's impeachment proceedings that begin next week. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has a report.
Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler set a deadline for next Friday for the president's lawyers to indicate if they plan to participate in his committee's hearings. He also asked for a list from GOP lawmakers of the witnesses they would like to question. The House Judiciary Committee meets Wednesday to examine the constitutional grounds for impeachment. The committee is also expecting a report from the House Intelligence Committee, which will form the basis of upcoming hearings. President Trump and his defenders continue to call the inquiry a witch hunt and say he did nothing wrong in his dealings with Ukraine. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Ahead of a United Nations climate summit in Madrid next week, demonstrators around the world are calling for more urgent action aimed at global warming. In Australia, many people blame climate change for the country's raging bushfires. Correspondent Phil Mercer is in Sydney.
Demonstrators have called on Australia to end its use of fossil fuels. That in the short term appears unlikely. Coal generates most of the nation's electricity and exports pump billions of dollars into the economy. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison is an ardent supporter of the coal industry. He castigated local council leaders for linking the deadly bushfires with climate change. Morrison has insisted Australia was taking its environmental obligations seriously. Friday's climate strikes were expected to take place in more than 2,000 cities in 153 countries, according to the Friday for Future movement. There were protests in Mumbai, Tel Aviv, Vienna and Frankfurt. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Iraq, the parliament meets on Sunday in emergency session. Topping the agenda, Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi's resignation letter amid weeks of deadly street protests which have taken hundreds of lives. Meanwhile, the violence continues with at least three more protesters shot by security forces in the southern city of Nasiriyah, where more than two dozen demonstrators were killed on Wednesday. More news at voanews.com. Gene Randall, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We still push for his release, and we still push for the full implementation of the agreement. As now, we have remained about 8 days from the 100 days that agreed upon in the interview meeting.
The SPLM-IO expresses displeasure with regional leaders for not lifting restrictions on its leader, Dr. Riek Machar.
Because when you raid that particular minister who is being referred, he was a very junior minister, new in the politics of this country. And so one would argue that it is because he is politically significant that he would be clamped upon just like that.
Ugandan opposition groups mock an upcoming anti-corruption walk to be led by President Yoweri Museveni.
We expect the government to maintain the momentum through the implementation of the recommendations of the dialogue. Some of them require legislation, others don't.
And three international organizations end an official visit to Cameroon with a call for efforts to restore security. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLM-IO, says it is displeased with the failure of regional leaders to resolve the status of their leader, former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar. The group says a recent summit of heads of state organized by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, promised to determine whether to lift restrictions it imposed on Machar. The restrictions were imposed as part of efforts to resolve the ongoing crisis in South Sudan after an alleged attempted overthrow of President Salva Kiir's government. For more regarding the group's concerns, I reach Pok Both Balwang, the SPLM-IO's Director for Information and Public Relations.
The entire people of South Sudan and the SPLM-IO fraternity are disappointed from the recent outcome of the IGAD head of state and government resolution. We were expecting that the chairman of the SPLM-IO, Dr. Riek Machar, was set free during this summit, because it was mentioned in the head of the state meeting before this one that the status of Dr. Riek Machar will be determined in the next ordinary summit, which took place yesterday. But unfortunately, nothing as such happened. This is where, as an SPLM-IO, we can see that the IGAD itself is not serious about the peace and process in South Sudan. Dr. Riek Machar was held against his will for about 3 years now since the outbreak of the conflict in 2016. No one will take responsibility, and we have not even informed that the reasons behind his restrictions and why he's been under the house arrest.
What difference does it make with regards to him being kept under house arrest? He's been invited to peace agreement meetings mediated by IGAD. So what will his confinement do? Why are you still displeased?
We are displeased because he was not set free. He's supposed to take part in the SPLM-SPLM-IO affairs. Now he's been kept away from his constituency, which is the SPLM-SPLM-IO. This is one. Secondly, he's not free to move. And the part of the restriction that he cannot address the media and he cannot attend any gathering rather than meetings that have been approved by the IGAD or the host country, which is now Sudan, and before, which is South Africa. If he was free, that he will take part in the dissemination of the agreement, and he will take part freely to engage the international community's factors on how to bring peace in South Sudan, but not just take permission just like now, because as you can see, the time that when he was invited to attend the treaty retreat in Rome, it took us almost like 1 week to get the permission for him to attend that the treaty retreat. This is kind of restriction that we are talking about now.
So why blame the IGAD and accuse IGAD of not being serious about the formation of a transitional government. IGAD has mediated the talks. You have signed the peace deal. Issues have come up. Both parties have agreed to extend the pre-transitional period for 100 days. Why blame IGAD for concerns that you may have?
First of all, IGAD are the part who held him under house arrest and house confinement and set up all these restrictions upon him. This is one. Secondly, yes, the IGAD has mediated and the peace process in South Sudan. IGAD itself is violating the agreement because there are provisions within the agreement said that all the political detainees and the prisoners of war should be released immediately after the signing of the agreement. Dr. Riek Machar is a political prisoner to the IGAD. They should release him immediately after the signing of the agreement.
Now, so what recourse do you have to address this concern? What will the SPLM-IO do next about this?
We still push for his release, and we still push for the full implementation of the agreement. As now, we have remained about 8 days from the 100 days that agreed upon in the Entebbe meeting. So we would like to urge the new chair of the IGAD, the Sudan Prime Minister, Dr. Abdullah Hamdok, so that he can expedite the issue of the release of Dr. Riek Machar, because the summit has referred this issue to his office.
Pork Booth Balwang is the SPLM-IO Director for Information and Public Relations. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The National Coordinator for the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition says opposition and civil society groups feel vindicated over the deteriorating human rights situation in the East African country. Onesmo Olengurumwa also says it is unfortunate that it has to take a continental body to urge the Tanzanian government to stop human rights violations. Supporters of the governing Chama Chama Pinduzi or CCM party have rejected their consent, saying critics of the administration have not been silenced. For more reaction, I reach Onesmo Olengurumwa in the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
Yes, I was actually welcomed that statement very positively because, first of all, it should be understood that the African Commission is our commission. We're quite happy that it is now our own solution within Africa that comes in at this time where we feel like human rights in the country, especially democracy, freedom, liberty, are not enjoyed as we used to experience and also as required according to various international and regional instruments, including the African Charter on Human and Civil Rights, of which that commission promotes.
What do you say to supporters of the Chama Chama Pinduzi or CCM, the governing party, saying that all the government has been doing is to stand up for the ordinary Tanzanian and to ensure their protection from those who are being manipulated by Western countries just to create tension and disaffection in the country? So the actions being taken by the government are legitimate to protect the ordinary Tanzanian. Your reaction to that?
Yeah, of course. Always such kind of propaganda. Therefore, such kind of perceptions and positions are just coming out as part of a defense of what is happening in the country. Sincerely, as a country, we are drastically stepping down when it comes to enjoyment of human rights, especially democracy. At this time when we have even elections and we find other people, opposition parties are outside the game, just because of some of the irregularities and complaints brought by them, and we don't see an effort that is taken by the government to meet together and dialogue around those issues. And actually today, some of the we've even had the result of the government election. Almost the Chama Chama Pinduzi won almost 100% because in most places the candidates went from the ruling party went uncontested. And those few who went for elections actually also won. So it's like a 100% election for just a single party. While the Constitution of the United Republic of Tanzania recognizes the country as the country of multi-party democracy.
Some people are suggesting that there are no limitations of freedom of speech and that opposition and civil society groups are still expressing their opinion. They are kicking against what they describe as policies that they sharply differ from the government. So it is quite unfortunate that the African Union Commission would say that the government is still limiting the freedom of speech and freedom of association when that is not entirely true, because they cite Onismo and other opposition groups from voicing their concerns about things they disagree with the government about.
For we activists and human rights experts, we understand that if we don't get an opportunity to express ourselves, or the citizens of this country don't have an opportunity to express themselves, that is one way towards violating other rights. Because if you beat me today and I cry, other people will hear. Now, if you cannot cry, you cannot associate, you cannot assemble, that itself, it manifests that as one way towards violating other rights. Therefore, these rights are cornerstone, are foundations of enjoyment of other rights. That's why we are saying, as a country, we need to go back and open up and allow people to associate, assemble freely, and also express themselves freely through various mechanisms, including NGOs, civil groups, religious groups, and political parties, as provided by our laws and the constitution of the country.
What is your reaction to the statement coming from the African Union encouraging the government to respect the Tanzanian constitution and enjoy multi-party democracy, not limiting right of speeches and freedom of association, which the government denies, by the way?
In one way or another, we are very sad that at this time we've gone at that level, being reminded to respect freedom and liberties. But also, as a human rights defender who has been participating in the African Commission, of course, communicating some of this information and encouraging them to do their role, I also feel like now the Commission is now going back to its role, because the African Commission, the Banjul Commission, is there for this work. Actually, the commissioners are employed, the Commission is there just to ensure that rights of people and citizens in Africa are respected and fulfilled among the member states of the African Union. And Tanzania is part of the African Union. It's a normal role of the African Commission, just to remind a member state to go back to the drawing board.
Onesmo Lengurumwa is the national coordinator for the Tanzanian Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, says it is mockery for President Yoweri Museveni to participate in the upcoming walk against corruption scheduled for Wednesday. The opposition party says the president is to blame for the endemic corruption in public institutions. The president is scheduled to lead the anti-corruption walk themed "A Corruption-Free Uganda Starts With Me" in the capital, Kampala. For reaction about the anti-corruption walk, I reached Patrick Oboy Amuriat, leader of the main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC.
Mr. Museveni shouldn't be the one to organize a walk of this kind, because he has got the powers and has set up institutions meant to fight corruption. And so, really, by organizing something of this kind, it is an indictment on Mr. Museveni himself as having failed in the war against corruption, the fight against corruption. That is one point. But secondly, and equally important, is the fact that Museveni has been in power for 33 years. He himself has been accused a number of times of being a corrupt person, including being used as evidence or an exhibit in the Federal Court of the United States of America for accepting a bribe from Mr. Patrick Ho, a Chinese national.
Some people are saying the Inspectorate of Government has described the forthcoming anti-corruption work as an indication of President Museveni's commitment and visibility in the fight against corruption. Why do you disagree with that?
I think that really first of all, even the same inspectorate of government is a toothless dog. He is unable to deal with corruption at the highest level. What the inspectorate itself does is to go around, you know, picking up small fish, while the most corrupt people, including Mr. Museveni himself and his ministers, are actually having a free ride on corruption. And I think that hailing Mr. Museveni without necessarily raising the red flag on him in as far as his own deeds is concerned is really missing the point. For me, I look at this as window dressing, something that is meant to make Mr. Museveni appear like he is clean and is committed towards the fight against corruption, and yet he's really the master of corruption in this country.
Supporters of the NRM are saying that the decision of President Museveni to remove from his government Herbert Kabafunzaki as the State Minister for Labour, Employment and Industrial Relations is a strong indication that he is fighting against corruption because of these allegations against the former minister.
How many Kabafunzakis have existed in this country? This is a question to ask. Many years ago, ministers were found wanting on the wrong side of the law in as far as corruption is concerned. Ministers were forced to resign on their own accord. Unfortunately, a minister like Minister Sam Kutesa was reappointed a few years to serve as Foreign Affairs Minister. And so, really, whereas Kabafunzaki has been removed from being a minister, or you know, has been suspended from being a minister, it does not mean that really this is a fight that Mr. Museveni is determined to win. Because when you read that particular minister who is being referred, he was a very junior minister, new in the politics of this country. And so one would argue that it is because he is politically insignificant that he would be clamped upon just like that.
Patrick Oboya Muriat is the leader of the Ugandan main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from Kampala. East Africa continues to struggle with heavy rains as thousands of people are displaced. In Kenya, the government said 120 people have been killed in flooding and mudslides during a severe rainstorm. Tens of thousands of people across the country have been displaced while infrastructure has been damaged, making aid delivery more difficult. Doctors are worried that diseases, especially waterborne ones, might spread. For more, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached Fred Omulo, a Kenyan journalist in Kisumu.
The areas that are affected are in northern Kenya, right near the border with Uganda. We have two counties there. One is called West Pokot County, and the other one is called Elgeyo Marakwet County. Now, these are counties that have significantly elevated altitude, and they tend to be very rainy, and they also tend to be very, very uneven. So there are so many cliffs, there are so many hills, there are so many places that expose the surrounding areas to these kinds of calamities. The situation there is it's still in an emergency state, because the rains which trigger these landslides are expected to subside in the middle of next week. But the significant event happened almost a week ago. I think it was on Saturday, and they are still trying to recover from the shocks of that major landslide.
We understand that there are lots of people who died, and some are unaccounted for as yet, and there is still a lack of medical attention. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. See, at least by today morning, or was it yesterday evening, about 60 people were confirmed dead. 10 more are unaccounted for. No one knows where they are. They could have been carried away. They could have been buried alive somewhere. 10,000 people have been displaced. Relief efforts have been ongoing. It's a multi-agency effort involving the government, involving Red Cross and other NGOs on the ground. We had about 40 medics who have been flown there. This includes doctors, pharmacists, surgeons, counselors, and all sorts of people. Had been airlifted and they were right there by Tuesday. So they've been trying to help the people there cope with the situation, but it's still very dire.
As you say, heavy rains are expected to continue across the country for some time. What are the plans for the people in those areas? Are they being resettled someplace, or what's the situation like?
Well, unfortunately, last Tuesday, they had already been issued with a mudslide warning because that place is prone to mudslides. Same thing with Elgeyo Marakwet County. But the mudslides that happened in Elgeyo Marakwet County did not affect people as much. People moved to higher ground or people moved to places that were not at risk. So the one who suffered this calamity last weekend are the people who stuck around. Probably it's a very remote place, so there's very poor communication, whether by mobile or radio or any other form. So a good number of them probably didn't even know what was going to happen, but the warning had already been given. As a result, a small number had already moved out of the place. They had gone to the Sokot, and those who remained were the ones who suffered the effects of that mudslide. Now they've set up a number of relief camps around the place, but you need to understand it's very difficult having these relief camps there when you have people in makeshift tents and it's raining. That's the challenge that they are facing up there.
Talking of putting their relief camps, according to reports, Kenya was already facing increased hunger prior to these floods. Is the government well equipped to handle the situation?
It's not really possible most of the time for the government to single-handedly deal with such a problem. They always have to bring some help from the Red Cross, from all sorts of relief agencies that may be around here, from Catholic Relief Services, the Anglican Relief Services. They always need some help, and these guys usually come in and they provide the kind of help that the government may not have. Sometimes they pull together their doctors from their institutional hospitals and they bring them to the field or whatever area it is. So you can never really say that the government can handle a problem single-handedly. As far as hunger is concerned, the situation is still unfolding. That place is very fertile and they tend to have food all year round. And even if they don't, they usually just get it across the border in Uganda. The situation is still unfolding. We can't really say how things will shape out over there.
Fred Omolo is a Kenyan journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kisumu. Africa, this is James Bratty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
And you're listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clothier, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, three international organizations have ended an official visit to Cameroon with a call for efforts to restore security, justice, and the conditions for the resumption of normal life in English-speaking regions of the country hit by the separatist crisis that has killed over 3,000 people. The Commonwealth African Union and the International Organization of La Francophonie delegation says it is convinced dialogue remains the preferred path for peace to return. The group urged the government to start implementing the recommendations of the last major national dialogue it organized. Some, however, have been critical of government efforts. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kezeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Moussa Faki Mahamat, chairperson of the African Union Commission, says after exchanging views with Cameroon President Paul Biya, Prime Minister Joseph John Goute, representatives of the main political parties, religious leaders, youth representatives, and a cross-section of Cameroonians, the organizations are convinced that there is a yearning for peace to return to the restive English-speaking regions.
Nous avons eu à relever la pertinence du grand débat national, des conclusions.
He says they noted that a majority of Cameroonians welcomed the convening of the Grand National Dialogue from September 30 to October 4, in which Cameroon's government consulted with political party leaders, activists, opinion leaders, traditional rulers, lawmakers and clergy, and are anxiously waiting for the government to implement its recommendations. Those recommendations include establishing some sort of special status for the minority English-speaking regions to be considered by the country's parliament. It also backed enforcement of the constitutional language giving English and French equal status and saying they must be used in all public offices and documents. It also backed continuing the process of decentralization by giving more powers and resources to local councils. Mahamat participated in the tripartite mission with International Organization of La Francophonie Secretary General Louis Moshikiwabo and Commonwealth Secretary General Patricia Scotland to encourage national peace efforts. Mahamat said after their meetings in Yaoundé, they observed that a large majority of Cameroonians supported the convening of the major national dialogue and believe it aided their quest for peace. He said they were convinced that dialogue remains the only path to peace and asked the government to implement the recommendations of the national dialogue. After the national dialogue, hundreds of prisoners were freed when Biya ordered a halt to court proceedings against them, saying he was implementing the recommendations of the dialogue. However, Albert Mvomo, an official of the opposition Cameroon United Party, says Biya's government has not been doing enough to solve the crisis. He says the AU, OIF and Commonwealth delegation should have proposed sanctions to force Biya to solve the crisis.
Quand on parlait de la résolution de cette crise, n'adressez pas les doléances au pouvoir de Yaoundé.
He says the three organizations, like any international organization, should force the government in Yaoundé to solve the crisis in the English-speaking regions through economic and diplomatic sanctions. He says Cameroon's government shows no serious sign of wanting to stop the crisis. Mvomo said the growing number of displaced people in towns and villages in the French-speaking regions showed the government has not been doing much to stop the separatist conflict. Simon Monzo, an Anglophone leader who took part at the national dialogue, says while some recommendations would require legislation, Cameroon should have started showing serious signs that it wants peace to return by restoring public infrastructure and villages and towns destroyed by the fighting for the population to return.
We expect the government to maintain the momentum through the implementation of the recommendations of the dialogue. Some of them require legislation, others don't. For example, rebuilding schools and bridges and all of that, you don't need legislation for that, except in terms of budgeting. Now, there are other aspects that would require modifying the constitution.
Separatists have insisted on social media that they do not recognize the outcome of the national dialogue and will be ready to negotiate with the Yaoundé government only on the terms of the separation of the English-speaking and French-speaking parts of Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
J. Kevin White is the founder of Global Vision 2020. It was founded with the aim to end the world's epidemic of poor vision. Kevin White, who is a retired U.S. Marine and a Naval Academy graduate, discovered the pervasive need for corrective eyewear among Africans while doing some humanitarian work for the Department of Defense. He invented the innovative UC Vision screening tool to provide prescription eyeglasses to people in remote parts of the world. To learn more about the Global Vision 2020 and how it is collaborating with aid organizations serving Africans, Kevin joins me live in the VOA studios here in Washington. Hello, Kevin, and welcome to Nightline Africa.
Hello, Peter. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Wonderful. So talk to me about Global Vision 2020. What motivated you to get this going?
Well, in 2005, as you mentioned, I was the director of humanitarian assistance programs for the DOD in Africa. And we would, every time a military unit would head to Africa, we would have some sort of humanitarian outreach program, whether that was engineers or doctors. And one of those outreaches included donated eyeglasses distribution. And as a lifelong wearer of eyeglasses, I was really drawn to see how that worked. And I was really shocked at the inefficiencies. No one got 20, or very, very few people got 20/20. No one got 20/20 in both eyes because prescriptions are different. And a lot of times people would pick the frame that style that they liked as opposed to the prescription that they needed. And I said, you know, even in you know, very, very poor areas, people don't want to look stupid. They want a nice pair of eyeglasses. So that got me thinking about the problem, and I started studying the problem. And when I retired, I started Global Vision 2020 to address those needs.
So far, how many people have benefited from this, and what is the plan moving forward? As big as it gets.
Yeah, so the like you mentioned, the problem is 2.5 billion people need but have no access to eyeglasses. So we have been producing our kits for a little over a year now, a year and a half, and we've reached about 40,000 people, mostly in Africa, in that time. About 40 different countries around the world, 38 different organizations. The majority of our current distributors are faith-based groups. Faith-based groups are easier to reach out to. They can turn the ship, as it were, very quickly to kind of take something on like this, because it is so easy to use that we can train someone how to use it in about 3 hours, and it takes about 10 minutes to give someone a pair of eyeglasses. My goal, of course, is to reach those 2.5 billion people. And the way to do that, of course, is government healthcare systems and government education systems, or even government transportation systems, where they have access to, you know, all of their citizens, all of their students, all of their people. And we change the conversation of where we can intervene with this. You know, task shifting is common in the medical community. You don't need to go get a prescription for a nutrient supplement for your child. For instance, a community health worker can provide that supplement to you. We come up with a system that's been tested and proven at a couple different universities that shows that with just a few hours of training, you can get a very accurate pair of prescriptions. So it's easy for us to kind of talk about task shifting to lower that down, so that instead of creating 50,000 optometrists, we can enable 50,000 government workers, for instance, to have this capability at their fingertips to help all of the people that they serve.
So in what
role can the government also play in providing or aiding the organization to provide the services to their own people, particularly looking at how much it will cost them,
right.
You know, to provide such a service?
Yeah, so there's a couple different things going on there. So it's the distribution is mm-hmm. is the main thing. The governments have much better and, you know, a fantastic distribution network at their fingertips. So we'll take Rwanda as an example. Mm-hmm. You know, the community health networks in Rwanda they're prolific. They're everywhere. Everyone has access to a community health worker with either in their village or within their district that they can reach for that first line of defense, that first medical line. Mm-hmm. So those sort of networks would be others. Demand is another one. So glasses aren't necessarily something that people even know that they need. The idea that the eye is an organ that varies from person to person is not common knowledge. And sometimes the idea that glasses are the tool that correct that is also not common knowledge. So getting that word out, you know, radio, getting that information out,
right.
That it's the world's largest disability, believe mm-hmm. it or not, poor vision, and it's the world's largest unmet disability. So the ability to correct it, whether it's for distance vision or for near vision, and having access to it and seeing how simple it is, and understanding that need or the value of that pair of eyeglasses is very important, and the government can help doing that too. And then the cost, like you mentioned, the cost of this, it's about $3 per person.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that we've talked about too is the getting them into Africa sometimes. Are glasses a healthcare necessity or a fashion accessory? And in the United States and Europe, it's kind of both. Mm-hmm. You sort of need glasses to see better, to cure your disability, mm-hmm. but people will spend $600-$700 on a pair because it has Versace or Gucci on the side. So the understanding that it is, at first and foremost, it's a healthcare necessity. So taxing it as a healthcare necessity as opposed to a fashion accessory would be very, very important to bring it into the country at that low cost so that the governments can take advantage of those low costs, and then the people can also take advantage of getting them at those low costs.
Talk to me about this equipment that you have. I understand you invented it. What went into this invention
yep.
and how does it work?
So if you want to see a picture of the UC on our website, gv2020.org, you can see a picture of it. But essentially, it looks like a pair of glasses, except it's got these two long lenses, these two 12-centimeter lenses on them. Mm-hmm. And the lens has a curvature to it that changes power as the user, dials it up and down. So we limit the patient to a very small viewing aperture, and as they turn that dial, it's just like a pair of binoculars. Mm-hmm. It moves that focal point very naturally across the retina, so when they're looking at an eye chart that's 4 meters away, they'll turn it until it becomes clear. And then I wanted to keep it very, very simple, so I color-coded it instead of using decimal places, you know, where math is required. I just, you know, made red 1234, green 1234. So if a patient dials into, you know, a green 2 on the left side and a red 4 on the right side, you simply reach into your box of lenses, which I have here, mm-hmm. and you pull out a red bag with a number 4 on it, a green bag with a number 2 on it, and then you have a lens. And the lens that's in that bag is exactly the same power as that strip of lens that the patient dialed into.
Right.
So you know you're going to get correlation between what they see through the UC mm-hmm. and what they see through the glasses. Then they pick a frame that they like, and there are different colors. So we have mm-hmm. blue, brown, and black, for instance, in this kit. And you simply pop out the lens, grab the lens that correlates to that, and it just lines up and snaps right in. And once it's snapped in, you clean it, you put it on the patient, you verify that they can see clearly, and then you're done. That's it. As long as they're seeing 20/20 mm-hmm. Or 20/40 or better, then you know that's going to work for that patient.
Mm. So far that you've been dealing with all these countries, how enthusiastic have these governments been in terms of helping you to reach out people who need it most? Because it will positively impact these individuals in their countries, and it will save them a lot of money in terms of economically and boosting the economy as well, because people will be able to work and they will prevent accidents from happening because people can't see.
Exactly. There's a lot to unpack there, mm-hmm. but you're absolutely right. So we haven't had a whole lot of luck reaching into governments just yet. We've reached out to a few, and when they've seen it, they've been very excited about it. But we have to work through the process of getting it approved in those countries and tested in those countries. You know, the fact that we've tested it at universities and done other trials elsewhere is good validation, but we also want to make sure that the governments are comfortable, you know, with it in their country. And we want to know what their bar is, and we'll meet that bar. But as far as value goes, yeah, the return on investment is really quite large. You know, at $3 per person, a few years ago, the WHO estimated that for every working adult that needs and has no access to eyeglasses, it basically costs that country's economy about between $1,700 and $1,900 a year. Mm-hmm. So the return, if a pair of eyeglasses lasts 2 years, I mean, that's a massive return on investment. But just... I mean, we've given glasses, like I gave glasses to a grandmother, and she couldn't see distance and she could not see clearly. So we gave her two pairs, one for distance and one for near. And the difference between when she got her glasses and when she didn't was drastic. When she was without her glasses, she sat in a corner and she depended upon someone in the family to feed her and to move her everywhere, take her, you know. Once she got her glasses, she became the matriarch of the family again. She read to the children, she prepared the meal, she fixed the clothes, she kicked everybody out of the house to, hey, go work, I've got this, I'll take care of the little kids. So for $6, she became the grandmother again that could participate in family life and pass on stories about her life to her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. It was amazing.
So talk to me about possible collaboration with other organizations here in the U.S., because I know you deal with the faith-based organizations and all that, but what other organizations can you collaborate with to help with this vision of yours?
Yeah, so any organization that basically travels or supports organizations overseas would be a great potential partner. So whether it's clinics. We partnered with an eye hospital in Lagos, Nigeria, for instance, and they get a lot of support from the U.S. So getting the kits to them is important. Getting that training, doing training online. So anytime we can get these, the kit comes as a complete system, by the way. It's like a suitcase size box. You open the box, you read the manual, and then everything you need to dispense 500 pairs of eyeglasses is in that box. So anyone who supports an organization overseas, we can help them enable that organization to serve more people and serve the people that are at most risk.
All right, Mr. White, before we go, what is your message to the people of Africa, where you visited a number of times, and to the rest of the world about this vision of yours?
So my message is that, you know, glasses have been around for 700 years. And 500 years ago, glasses were dispensed in Italy, and about 50 years after that, we're in the middle of the Renaissance. And so one of the main contributors to that was, of course, you had people living into their 60s and 70s that used to not be able to work, but could continue work, continue education, engineers, artists, you know, you name it. Africa's never had its opportunity to have a Renaissance. You know, there's a whole group of people that are sidelined because of this disability, and getting them back into the workforce, getting them to be contributing members of their society, they want that, they need that, and we can do that cheaply, ethically, efficiently, and this is the way to do it. It's to lower that educational threshold so that we can increase the piece of the pie, increase the umbrella of eye health to get glasses to the base of the pyramid. And then those very few optometrists and ophthalmologists that we have, it's about 1 to 1 million, they can now concentrate on those bigger problems, the trachomas, the cataracts, the you know, macular degeneration and things, because they don't need, we can handle so much more of the refractive error, the need for eyeglasses, at a much lower level.
Thank you very much. J. Kevin White is the founder of Global Vision 2020. He joined us live from the VOA studios right here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from the band Becca with Brave. Timaya follows with Silicon, Mbongeni Ngema with My Baby, and then Kwame Eugene ends it all with Angela.
them a galante. All my pretty girls, them a wine for. When I come around, them a feel a pay. Everybody knows, say, love is to the yo. Everybody yo, oh. When I come around, they no give me Buddha yo. They say, all my girls come, it's a silicone yo. And nobody know, nah, only me know. Me and my father yo. Okuba Buddha yo. Come it and I jam it and I jam it. Every boys and girls, I'm love it. And the way me have it spin it. All the ladies, them I wine it. All the girlie, them I bump it. Bump and grind, ta 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 ta. Everybody, yo, oh. When me come around, they no give me Buddha, yo. They say, all my girls come, it's a silicone, yo. And nobody know, nah, only me know. Me and my father, yo. Okuba Buddha, yo. Omo Buddha, yo. For me.
was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Mr. John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if a dead tree falls, it carries with it a live one. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.